Okay.
Welcome to the Permaculture Pimp Cast with your host, the Permaculture Pimp Daddy and the Pasture Raised Pimp. Get your recommended daily allowance of permaculture, preparedness, and practical living. Tip a pimp. Stay alert, stay alive. Permaculture is my passion. Oh yeah, welcome to the bonus episode of the Permaculture Pimp Cast, where pimp stands for permaculture is my passion. The only pimp cast on planet Earth where we discuss permaculture, preparedness, and practical living. Folks, I'm really excited today, but before we get into it, remember, this episode is always brought to you by Hickory Ridge Soap from twooldcrowshomestead.com. Turn that simp into a pimp. Bam! Also, Heaven's Harvest, y'all, 10% off with promo code PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. Remember, handle all your preparedness needs over there. And remember, in these times we live in, we don't worry about the fear, but we worried about preparedness. That's another reason why I'm uber excited about our guest today. Don't worry, folks. Hang on there. Wait for it. It's going to happen. All right. Also, EMP Shield, y'all, $50 off with promo code PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. Remember, your number one threat is not necessarily an EMP. It's lightning strikes, and they guarantee you up to 25 Gs if anything gets past that surge protector and blows up your house. And if you would like to tip a pimp, go check us out on the Fountain app, where you can listen to all your podcasts over there. Remember, start with the Pimp Cast. You can triple up the speed. You can leave comments, all that good stuff right over on the Fountain app. And remember, if you'd like to tip a pimp, you can do it in the form of SATs or what they call Satoshis or whatever they call those things these days. And it's a derivation of a Bitcoin. So if you'd like to tip a pimp, if you'd like to drop some SATs on some PIMPs, go ahead and drop it over there at the Fountain app. You know how to do this. All right, y'all. And finally, Harvest Right freeze dryers. Make sure you get one if you need one. And if you can afford one right now, it's a big, big help. All right, y'all, I'm kind of nervous. In fact, I'm about as nervous as R. Kelly standing outside of a daycare right now, because I got a couple of heroes of mine on the line with me right now. And these are folks, look, if you've listened to this PimpCast from the very beginning, you'll know that in the top three of all my inspirations out there for what we do here at the at Billy's Jungle Palace of Love, here high atop the mountains in Mars Hill, North Carolina, you've heard me talk about these folks a bunch of times, more than I can count. And I can't even begin to tell you the joy I have right now that I actually have them right here on the PimpCast with me. And it's Sean and Beth Doherty. You know who they are because you've heard me talk about their book. If you're watching on YouTube, it's this one right here, The Independent Farmstead. In my view, pretty much the Bible for homesteading done in the most magnificent way. And in fact, it's really permaculture when you get down to brass tacks. It's also preparedness. And I know record numbers right now are getting into the preparedness space. You're getting into the farming space. And I can think of no better guest to have right now with all the nonsense going on in the world. Welcome, Sean and Beth. How are y'all?
Very good. Thank you. We're so happy to be with you, Billy.
That was a great workup, Billy.
Well, it's all true.
I'm not going to feel the same way about myself.
Well, it's a journey, but I got to be honest with y'all. I'll be honest with you. I don't even know where to start, but every good superhero has an origin story. So, I've told people about the work you do, but why don't you give them a little bit of background on where you came from and what brought you to this work?
Well, when we were in Ohio, we had come there. I was a teacher at Franciscan University, and we were looking for a place to settle some roots. We had both grown up doing weekend farming or hobby farming or something like that with our families.
Our dads were farm boys who had grown up during or right after the Depression and had gotten city jobs, health professional jobs, but never got the hayseed out of their hair enough. So they bought hobby farms, and we grew up in that situation, you know, moving cows on the weekend, planting gardens, keeping pigs.
So we came to Steubenville, Ohio, and we thought we were on the suburbs of New York. It was very weird coming from Oklahoma and Texas. But we knew that we wanted to try and find a place to settle down. We looked and looked and looked and looked and finally found a little scratch piece of land that the state of Ohio called not suitable for agriculture. And we thought we'll work on this place. And then
Billy, it was trees straight up the side of a hill. And the only open ground was covered with brambles. It was a house and 16 plus acres for $11,000. And it wasn't selling. That's how bad it was.
Right. So we were in a holler, as they say here. So it was a real adjustment. But we decided after being here a little while, let's go ahead and put in a garden. We brought in some goats. We started doing some things. And this was our education. We started off on something that was absolutely terrible, and we turned it into a farm. And one of the things that we tell everybody, and this has to do with survival, is take the piece of land that you have, the little scratchy edges, pieces of land. We can't afford what's left of the farms. The commercial guys are taking all the stuff that looks like a farm. So we have to take the stuff that does not look like a farm and turn it into a farm. And we believe you can do it.
Most of the farmland in the country no longer belongs to farmers unless you count somebody who pays somebody else to drive a tractor over 20,000 acres of soybeans. If you count him a farmer, maybe it still belongs to farmers, but it really belongs to just rich guys in the city. And we can't compete with them.
No.
But every scrap of land on the planet deserves to be treated respectfully. And a whole lot of it will repay that respect with not just food for the moment, but like fertility and beauty that grows, that increases every year. Well, I don't know. We've been on this land for 27 years and it hasn't stopped getting more beautiful, and we don't anticipate it will. So it just gets better and better.
One of our goals was to try and figure out how Grandma and Grandpa farmed, because they didn't have feed stores. They didn't have grocery stores. They managed to get their food and their animals' food from the farm. And we're thinking, how does that work? So, and this goes a lot with what permaculture is trying to do. But the key that we found is the dairy cow. The dairy cow eats for free because you have grass. Almost no matter where you are, you're going to have grass. And the cow can live completely on grass, does not need grain, despite what some people will tell you. And so now we've got an animal that will turn the thing that we cannot eat into the best food on the planet, raw milk. And raw milk feeds everything on the farm. It feeds us, feeds our animals, feeds the garden, feeds the soil. It's fabulous.
You know, like most of the land we own the home farm is 24 acres. And of that, probably close on 20 is trees straight up the side of a hill. We're all in favor of trees because these trees on our steep hillsides are holding soil, building fertility, dropping leaves that come down into the holler and fertilize the ground. They're hanging on to our water. They're a huge part of our hydration, you know, our the water movement on our land. But trees typically produce one crop a year, be it leaves, be it nuts
apples
or fruit. They produce one crop a year. Grasslands are capable of producing 4, 5, 6 crops a year if they're grazed properly, which means that the practicality of getting food off land becomes not a question of how do I plan a 12-month cycle in which I harvest everything in one small piece of that year, and then it has to be stored and last for the whole year. It's how can I feed myself from my daily sunlight every day over the course of 12 months? And that's where grasslands are super significant in any human foodscape. If you look around at the cultures on the planet, going back as far as you like, you'll find that the majority of them are not deep woods cultures. They either are grasslands cultures, or they are, you know, sort of a patchwork of woods and grasslands, because we're dependent on that daily harvest. We need to be able to get at the sunlight that's falling each day. And as long as, you know, in a hunter-gatherer culture, you can do that by pursuing large herds and harvesting reasonable amounts of the individuals in the herd over time. But as soon as you become an agrarian or a pastoral culture that keeps herds, it becomes possible to use milk, you know, every day's sunlight converted in that day into milk that you can harvest twice a day, to use milk as the foundation of culture. And that was something we did not work out except in practice. We milked a cow and then were overwhelmed by the volume of milk we were getting, and then began to piece together not only, oh, we can feed this to our pigs, chickens, dogs, and cats and cut our feed bills and then eventually to reduce them to nothing, but we realized then through our reading, oh, we're just doing what all our ancestors have done for as far back as we have records for. And the reason the records didn't tell us that is that you don't write down what everybody knows. You write down new stuff. So farming books, and our investigations go back more than earlier than the 1600s. We'll even reference some ancient Greek and Roman texts as we're figuring out farming. As far back as we go, people typically don't write about how grandpa did it, but how we propose to do it in the future, how we're going to change the system. So you really have to go far back before you can find instructions that just say, graze animals, milk them, and that milk is solar energy being made available to all the animals who can't get it just by eating grass. That would be us and any other non-ruminant on the farm.
And then the thing that the cow does, which is, you know, we really believe that this is all this wonderful pattern that God created for us, that when he put us out here, he did not set us out here as a trap or a trick or a, this isn't going to work.
Or a zero-sum game.
Or a zero-sum game. But if you manage your cows well, and that means manage them on pasture well, that means rotating them every day, not only are they feeding you with this incredible abundance of milk, meat, but then they are also providing the manure, and they're grazing, the way that they graze improves the pastures. So every day that we are getting fed abundantly, we are also improving how the cows are eating on the land. It's if you follow the pattern, if you do what God has set out for you, everything gets better.
It's like a miracle. The more you eat, the more there is.
Yeah, it's a fabulous system. We don't call it a system, we call it a pattern. Yeah.
Folks, you got to be glad you tuned in already. I mean, this is worth the price of admission already, and it's about to get even better, which, by the way, was free. So if you want to check us out on the Fountain app, be sure to do that. But if you want to, please do. Go out there and spread this thing far and wide, because we are living at a time on this planet where people need to hear this information, and you need to get their book. Folks, remember, when everybody asks, when they go out there and ask, okay, what are the 5 books? I get asked this all the time. Right there next to Fukuoka is this book, The Independent Farmstead. And we're going to look, you already got a taste as to why I say this is a must have, and you need to have it, especially right now. So folks, back to Sean and Beth, let me go ahead and ask what ought to be the obvious for so many people out there right now. As you know, you just came back from HOA, and we see record numbers getting into this space. And like you guys, I was country when country wasn't cool. But, we've had over the last several years, we've had a pestilence, whether contrived or not. I'll leave that to other people to determine. We've had the Arab Spring, and now we're approaching what I'm going to call the winter of our discontent. And okay, that's kind of an inside joke. I shouldn't do that on radio, but
Ricardo Tercero.
There you go.
These two guys have a mutual theater background. They're both Okey boys who grew up in the theater. And when they're together, I can't stop them swapping Shakespeare quotes. Half the time, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Beth, there was no way I was going to stage the next question without breaking out some Richard III. No way. And it's also very fitting in the times everybody feels like they're in right now. So in this world where everybody, where everything seems topsy-turvy. I mean, every single time you turn around, it's the latest pestilence, it's the latest war, whether contrived or otherwise. You know, I'll leave everybody up. You know, you can determine that on your own. But at the end of the day, you guys talk solutions, which is what is just downright intoxicating to not only myself, but so many others out there, where there's this world where everybody said, here's your problem, here's your problem, here's your problem. You have provided unbelievable, profound solutions that, like you said, are perhaps really a renaissance of what was known long ago. I never really thought about it that way. I never really thought about that. So in this world where everything is going upside down, people are getting into this space. Good night. I wish this interview could go for 10 hours, because honestly, it would take that long to unfold all the knowledge they have. But let me just ask you this. For all those people that are approaching this space right now that are feeling, you know, desperation, fear primarily, what advice right off the bat for those people that are getting into this space would you offer? And yeah, we can unfold more of your book. I want to get to that. But so many people are asking, where do I start? So what's your answer to those people?
Well, one of the things that we say is you need to have the homestead mentality. And the homestead mentality is a lot of it's built on the faith that this works, that, you know, you're staring at a dead animal and you still believe, no, that was, that's the off. It works. The whole pattern works. If you follow the pattern, if you're good to your farm will feed you abundantly. So that would be the main, the starting point is this whole pattern works.
Right. And Sean often tells people, you know, within 5 minutes of where you live, there's land that somebody is not using. Now, granted, if you're living in the middle of a big city, this is less true. But for most of us, within 5 minutes, at least 5 minutes drive at the moment of where you live, there's land that somebody's not using. And it's for us to move forward as a bunch of people riding a culture that's headed for a brick wall. It's really important for us to begin thinking independently and unconventionally. We don't need to own the land we're managing, right? Because the minute there's a disaster, the title at the courthouse is not going to be worth the paper it's printed on. It's going to be who's here and who knows how to use this land.
Sure.
So if we can begin to think not despairingly, I can't afford to buy the place in the country I think I need, but anywhere there's a half an acre of soil that's, you know, growing something, I can go begin to manage that with grazing animals. That's going to begin to free us up, one, to learn the craft, and two, to let the craft show us how well it works. The solution is out there. A family can grow all its own food on a couple of acres. And I don't mean what people usually mean by that when they say, oh, a garden, you know, that's 40 by 50 feet is big enough to grow all the vegetables for a family of five. True, to a certain extent and in certain climates. But what people keep overlooking, you know, we've had this conversation before about how sometimes people will hijack the word permaculture on behalf of, and probably without understanding they're doing so, hijack it on behalf of veganism or vegetarianism, as though animals don't play a significant role in land management and food production. But in general, plants are going to be short on fats and proteins, and they're seasonal, and they're we can only eat the parts of them that are not, or at least we can only digest the parts of them that are not primarily cellulose. The minute you bring one of the grazing ruminants into the picture, historically human beings have done in the West have done most of their cooperating with ruminants that are cows, sheep, or goats, but there are lots of other ones. Reindeer in Finland, for example, the minute you bring in a ruminant, you've got access to the energy, the solar energy trapped in cellulose. Grasslands are 80% cellulose. And not only you and I can't digest that, but our pigs and chickens can't digest it. Soil biota can, so they can turn it into fertility. But as soon as we begin grazing animals in natural patterns, in biomimicry, we have access to that 80% of the plant material, the energy, the photons captured, converted into ATP in that cellulose become available to us when we cooperate with a cow or sheep or goat, and she turns them into proteins and fats. The very things our tomatoes and our romaine and our green beans are going to be low in.
So all of you folks out there that are reaching out saying, oh, I'm a survivalist, I'm all this, I'm all that. Well, how many times have I pointed out to you the hardest thing to find in nature is fat? You get 4 calories per gram of carbs and protein. You get 9 per gram with fat. And guess what that milk is? There's a good piece of it in there. So that is what is absolutely so sublime. And it's what drew me to your work so much is that it is, I can only drink so much milk a day. Right. I can only make so much cheese, but I got pigs and chickens out here that will go nuts on the stuff. Absolutely. And it's just absolutely magnificent. So for all of people out there that watch my YouTube videos and watch the patterns that we've done, whether it's the chicken tractor on steroids, how we do a lot of what we do here in permaculture, guess who I got it from? And I'm shouting it from the rooftop. I can't believe I have not had them on here before now. I thought, as I told you before, that I thought that I had invented this thing. No, I didn't. And then I found out there's people that are doing it light years better than me. So I'm like, okay, first thing to do, buy the book. What you need to go do is go to their website. Buy the book because they left no stone unturned. And in fact, their website, I would call an awesome addendum to the book as far as all the things you can grow. You can pay for a PDF, which Michelle did a while back. And that yard of Trombocinos we got out there, who do you think we got them from? Back in 2019, Beth handed Michelle a handful of Trombocinos. And now we're giving away the seeds because they are so unbelievably prolific. They keep forever in a day. We've had some out there that sat almost a year and were still perfectly fine, along with Kushal, Squawkies, Kazunis, all these other things that we're feeding our animals on. And these are the geniuses that whose plan I'm following. And so, folks, if you're wondering why we do this or where we got it from, we're talking to him right now. Sean, you wanted to say something?
We just reached back into history. That's all we did. We didn't do anything marvelous or miraculous. There is a source that's really good, the Cornell.
So when we began to do research into, you know, what we were looking for, Billy, it's what we're, when we set out to homestead, what's the first big thing we stub our toes on? It's the feed bill for the chickens, the pigs, if we have, is a feed bill for everybody, because we typically think we have to buy feed for all our animals,
including
even our
cows,
ruminants, right?
Right.
And so as we were, you know, we'd always wanted to farm, and we always knew we didn't want to farm the way we had seen it done in our childhood. We wanted a work of art, right? And we knew that nature does that. But when we looked for instructions, they all went, okay, go to the feed store and buy a sack of feed. So when we were looking for other information, one thing we stumbled upon, and I don't remember how, is an online library at Cornell University. You can, you know, do a search and it'll come right up. Core Historical Literature of Agriculture Library at Cornell University. And you can actually, it's not presently super well, what's the word I want? It's
indexed.
It's not very well indexed. I always have trouble with that word. In that it's hard to look stuff up. But you can make a choice like, I'm going to go back to 1720 and look at the list of books published between 1720 and 1740. And by title, I'll see if I can find one on, say, how to raise pigs. And then you can look at the table of contents for that book and just sort of scroll through and see what you can find. And that library gave us access to information. Like we said, people didn't usually write about how their granddads farmed. They were writing about their own brilliant ideas about how to change it. But we'd find information like this. Humanity has not previously to petrochemicals and big machinery has not liked to feed grain to animals. It's kind of backward. But human beings who can eat that grain and access the energy a lot more directly. But perishable crops when we have a surplus of them, can be very sensibly fed to animals that can turn them into proteins and fats. Most of our crops are not going to be, you know, where do our fats come from if we're vegans? Places like olive oil, which most of us can't get at and don't have the equipment to press. But we can take our primarily cellulose crops or primarily plant crops, feed them to pigs and chickens, and they can turn them into the little protein packet we call an egg, or the big protein and fat packet we call bacon. And they can do that while taking our excess, our surplus. In fact, all of the plant material that we produce over the course of a year that isn't actually food. Think, I eat a tomato, but I don't eat a tomato plant. That tomato plant can be put through a pig and turned into bacon, with the exception that it's not enough nutrition until you add milk. It's since the pig can't break down cellulose the way a cow can, he needs that extra milk that we can push through. We can send to the pig pen every day as it comes into the house in quantities we do, greater than we need. And then he's suddenly freed up to take all of our waste plus milk and turn them into, as you say, the fat that is not going to be present otherwise in most of our permaculture plant systems.
Folks, this is exactly what I'm talking about. All the people that have hit me up in the past and said, well, how is it? We're having a little bit of feedback, I think, on your end. I'm going to mute you for a moment for some reason. Yeah, I'm going to mute you for a moment and then I'll come back to it. Folks, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You know, we've done video after video after video of how we raise all of our chickens for free, all of our meat birds for free, all of our ruminants for free, and our pigs we raise for 21 cents a pound because we don't get farrow our own pigs. 21 cents a pound, and of course, me being a trained butcher, I mean, look, there's not even that cost. And also, Sean and Beth process their own meat, as I understand it as well. Look. Bottom line, folks, we have inflation going through the roof. And it's only going to get worse. Look, I'm not trying to be a doom and gloomer here, but, you know, the facts are what they are. And with all the nonsense going on in the Middle East, well, if it escalates, what do you think is going to happen to the price of oil? There are prognosticators out there saying that it may go through the roof. Well, guess what? The inflation can do whatever it wants, but right now it's not costing me a dime. I got six freezers in the garage with meat that's so good that you can't begin to buy it. And it was all free. Thanks to the knowledge that I got from Sean and Beth. Also, you know, I've also given many a hat tip to people like Jeff Lawton, Bill Mullison. There's a long list of others, but I'm telling y'all, right at the top of the list has been Sean and Beth, because look, if you get into this space and you're on the feed wagon, or like Jim Garrish calls it, you haven't yet kicked the hay habit, which, you know, there are roles for hay and everything out there. But the point being, if you're in this space to try to save money and you're still out there buying all of your feed, which is only going to go higher as the cost of fuel goes up, it's already high to begin with. You're not really extracting yourself from the matrix. You're really not. So it's their ideas, folks. This is probably in the top two most important. I said in the last podcast, it was probably one of the most important, where I'm talking about grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And that's basically a mental antivirus. But I would say even more important is this show right now. So folks, you need to spread it far and wide. Give us a 5-star review anywhere you're listening to this Pimpcast right now, because it's really that important. It's that consequential right now. And I am an open example of what you can do with the information that you get from people like these. I got you unmuted again. So hopefully, yeah, it looks like our problems have solved.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about hay, because for a long time we were buying hay in, and in terms of managing your pastures, you can even eliminate the hay bill. So what we do is a thing called stockpiled forage. And starting in August, September, we set aside half the farm that we just let it now grow. And then we're going to come back into it in December or so. And in the meantime, we're running our cows on the other half of the farm. And then in December, we're running them on stockpiled forage. So we are on pasture all year round. There's about 3 weeks out of the year when we've got ice on top of snow that we need to, we don't need to, but we choose to give them hay. The rest of the time they're on pasture the whole time. So we don't even have to buy in hay, which is a great.
Right. When there's ice on snow, Billy, I could go out with a hoe and break the ice so the cows could get at the grass underneath. I'm just a little lazy about that right now. So for those days, you know, thick ice over snow, which is over the grass, we'll take square bales out and break them up in a paddock and feed the cows in that spot. You know, I know you totally understand the idea that we can enjoy our luxuries. We just need to make sure they stay luxuries. I drink coffee. I'm going to have to give it up one of these days because I firmly believe we're going to stop having the settled economy that makes long distance shipping possible. In the meantime, I can afford to drink coffee. I'm going to go on drinking it, but I know how I'll manage without, you know, it's not crucial to our lifestyle. When we have an addiction to somebody else's grass harvested with a lot of petroleum and heavy metal, or an addiction to somebody else's grain, then we're going to have a problem when it's not there anymore. We need to be building resilient systems. And what's a resilient system? It's one that's based on the facts of nature that aren't going to change no matter who's in charge or who's dropped a bomb or, you know, who can stop us accessing our luxuries.
And it's also based on local. We were just speaking with our small group, the Healing Land, last night, and we're talking about setting up some lectures where we're going to talk about local and staying local. One of the things that we think would be great for everybody is to say, all the things that I get at Walmart, instead of going to Walmart first, why don't I ask in my community, where could I find that in my community? And that's what we've done on our farm. Anytime we see cash going off our farm, we say, how could the farm provide that? So if I am starting to pay, our whole system is a cash-based system. Everything that we get is cash. Our heat is cash. Our water is cash. Our sewers are cash.
We can't flush our own wastes away without paying money to do that, which shows just how helpless modern urban human beings have become.
But what if we started saying, how could my farm do that? So for heat, what if we heated with wood? What if instead of flushing our waste away, we did bucket toilets and we put them in compost? We do that at our Airbnb.
We do that in our home because we live in the Airbnb.
Right. So there's just every time that we see ourselves solving our problems with cash or going to Walmart, what if we just paused and said, I wonder if there's a way that my community could provide this, or my local community, or if my farm could provide this. And we just started thinking differently about where we get our needs from and then eliminating needs.
You know, let me add to that. You know, some people are highly critical of certain groups out there, but you know what, to their credit, the Muslim community right here in the United States, before a single dollar leaves that community, it will pass hands up to 20 times before it ever leaves that community.
That's so fabulous.
Say what you want about them. I don't have any problem with these folks by and large, but the point being is there something we should be asking, critically, this seems to be something that they do quite well. Maybe we might want to replicate that. Like you said a moment ago, Beth, you know, instead of me going to Walmart to go buy soap, well, there's a lady down the road from me that's making it out of goat milk.
Right.
I've tried to initiate things like this over and over and over again, but I think in so many ways it takes the crucible of really hard times for us to wake up and, you know, and ask these critical questions. Sadly, we have to, like a person using drugs, you got to hit rock bottom. But why on earth can't we exchange this money within our community? Let's say up there in Ohio, you're producing something. I had this initiative, I thought, and I haven't yet released it to it. I'm like, let's just start with one room in the house. For example, the kitchen. Okay, let's start with the kitchen. Okay, in this community, do we have anybody out there that might be able to make some legit dish soap that doesn't have weird chemicals in it? Oh, while we're at it, maybe there's somebody out there. Let's just start with the items that are in a kitchen for cleaning, let's say. Let's solve that problem. Let's get people within our communities, even whether they're virtual communities, if you can't find, I mean, if you live where I do, I'm on the side of a mountain. I can't even see my next door neighbor. So it's going to be a little difficult for where I am, but we have this thing called the internet, at least for now. They haven't yet, you know, EMP Shield hasn't had to live up to their warranty just yet. So while we still have this convenience, maybe there are places around us, whether it's in our local communities or whether they're virtual communities, where we might want to buy these things. So instead of giving this money to Walmart that's going to do who knows what with it, let's maybe start within these communities and start with a single solitary place in the home. Let's get all these items in the kitchen. Now, who's going to make them? Okay, you handle this. I'll handle this. You handle whatever. Maybe I'm the guy, because I am a butcher that was trained by Michelin star chefs. Maybe I'm the guy that processes the meat. Maybe there's somebody over here that makes sausage out of it because I want to, you know, add value to it. Maybe there's somebody down the road that will produce with the hogs they process. Maybe they supply the casings for this guy's sausage. This is how things were done. And that's what the beauty of what you provide, not only in your book, but what you evangelize in every single engagement, is that just like when Rome fell, okay, the classical age, well, they were in what some folks would call the Dark Ages, although they weren't exactly in the Dark Ages in the Middle East at that time. Right. But let's say this Dark Ages that went on. Well, what happened after hundreds of years when people are walking by the Colosseum looking up and thinking aliens built this stuff because they couldn't understand that this classical age had passed them? So what did they call what happened when Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and all the others came back around? They called it a renaissance, which means rebirth. Folks, that's what Sean and Beth have done in their book and in their work. And I love how you put that, Beth, where you're saying, well, we didn't really invent any of this stuff. And like Sean, you said either, we're like, we're looking at old sources and we're like, okay, this is really a renaissance of all these things that were forgotten, because nobody is, as crazy as it sounds, nobody ever thought that, hey, this is how grandpa's doing it. I mean, it's really astonishing when you think about it.
The other thing that we are always thinking about is we do believe that eventually the system is going to break down. So we don't necessarily have to cut ourselves off and go off grid, but we need to be ready when it happens. So when it comes to water, we need to have backup systems. We know how to tap into a spring. We know how to catch springs. We know how to catch seeps. We're doing them now. You know, one of the good things for us was that our water at our house was not enough water to feed our animals and feed our garden. If it did well in the house, but it wouldn't do the rest. So we had to start figuring out, how are we going to water our animals? How are we going to do that? And through that process, we've come up with some great workarounds, catching springs, holding water, finding ways to contain it, how to get it out of a creek so that I can use it. These have all been fabulous. And we do workshops on farm about them. We go to conferences and talk about them.
I think one of the things that has been like hugely successful over the past, say, 300 years is, you know, when we invent something new, we stand on the rooftops and we shout and holler, you know, like, look how clever I am. I've invented, you know, the cotton gin, or I've invented the internal combustion engine. And it gets very exciting, you know, look how clever we are. But, the flip side of that has been that with each new invention, each year that passes, each time we say, boy, that's clever, that's cool, I want one, and we start to use it, we've built up this mythology about the past that's pretty funny, because it has two parts that don't go together. One is that all the people in the past were sick, miserable, overworked, tired all the time, filthy, you know, that the past was this time of intense drudgery. And the other, so I'm sort of mixing this up, because it's intense drudgery mixed with acute illness and near starvation all the time. And I'm trying to picture my ancestor who was near starvation and could never get well from his illnesses, who was also working twice as hard as I am. The thing doesn't hold water. As you know, I went to school just like anybody else. I learned that in my history classes. You know, my caveman relatives were died young, you know, constantly ill, that people prior to the Industrial Revolution worked from sunup to sundown in backbreaking labor and still barely got by. And the thing doesn't really, the math doesn't work out. As we began farming and discovering that nature really has patterns that work in our favor, we began to find out that the work we do outside is delightful. The results of the work are beautiful. The food we eat is beyond anything we ever remotely imagined when we were growing up on city food.
We're healthier.
Yeah, we're healthier. And then there's something that happens in our minds. And that takes me back to the image I messed up a minute ago of our ancestors being at the same time grossly overworked and also really, really ill and miserable and sick. You know, if that's the image you have of the universe, that it wants to hand human beings death and starvation, that's a pretty stinky universe and not very much fun to live in. But when you begin to farm according to natural patterns, and those are the patterns we call permaculture, among other things, right? That's one of the words for farming with nature. When we begin to farm with nature, our understanding of the universe makes a radical shift. And we come to see ourselves as belonging here, part of something that is fundamentally good and beautiful and bountiful and healthy and loving. And we belong here. When we walk out in our pastures.
And humans are an addition to.
Right, right.
We are not the terrible thing that is destroying it all. We can do a lot of destruction. And we can, when we get away from the patterns and start farming in our clever commercial ways where greed is the primary driver, we can do a lot of damage. But we don't have to do that. We can be the what God put us here to be, good tenders to the garden.
Right. So an example we like to use in workshops and talks is in nature. Nature tends to operate in boom and bust cycles. When I was a kid, ecology was taught by the example of the snowshoe hare and the Arctic fox. As long as there's grass, the snowshoe hares multiply, the Arctic foxes hunt the snowshoe hares, and they multiply until there are so many bunnies that there's no more grass, and the bunny population crashes, and the fox population crashes, which gives the grass a chance to start growing again, and the whole thing happens over. Boom and bust cycles. Humanity is here to flatten that curve, to bring about order and plenty without the sort of nature red in tooth and claw extremes at both ends. And the way Native Americans used to do that, and people all over the world, I just happen to know the Native American example, is that they had the insight into their natural environment that let them look at the size of their feral herds and the amount of grass in any given year and make a judgment about how many animals should go into the winter, because that's how much the grass will support. And they would actually chase or lure huge herds of buffalo over a cliff to reduce the size of the herd, because they knew that if all these animals go into the winter on the grass that's available, they'll starve to death before the new grass comes in the spring. Whereas if we can reduce the herd, there will be enough grass to feed them. Well, that's exactly the kind of decision that we homesteaders, we farmers make on our own land every fall when we look at the grass that's there and the numbers of our herds and say, okay, we need to maybe butcher a couple of steers and maybe sell a young cow off the farm so that the number of animals I take into the winter is the number I know this grass can feed and still have a little bit left over on April 15th, which is about when our grass greens up again. That's our job. That's what we do. We can make landscapes bountiful, fruitful, and on some level predictable. Human populations don't like the boom and bust, you know, like feast and famine cycle, because starvation is unpleasant. And we can bring to our farming the ability to help the landscape and the wild and domestic animals avoid those boom and bust cycles too.
One of the things that we always say is that in making choices about the farm and about our gardens and stuff like that, that the primary, the most important consideration is the family. How is this going to help the family? If this is going to be hard on the family, then we need to. But the second is the soil. The soil has to be the primary decision, not how many animals I want, but how many animals will be good for this soil. And we are not about making petting zoos. We're about making farms where the animals all work together to with us to make this farm a better place. Every choice has to consider first the soil.
Which is why intensive rotational grazing, holistic grazing, you and I know, like we all know there are 20 different terms, each vying for most important, but they all mean ecologically appropriate grazing patterns that keep the soil covered, put down deep roots, build fertility into the soil so that those grasslands that we know we can harvest multiple times over the course of a 12-month period, so that those grasslands go on producing, capturing sunlight to produce plant matter that will feed the whole farm and the soil year round over and over and over again.
This is
most
exactly
years you
I'm
end up with more
about.
Than you need.
Yeah, this is what folks, just to give you a basis of how productive, and remember the good Lord gave us dominion over all things. That doesn't mean rape, which is exactly
That's
what
right.
most
That's
modern
right.
farming is. Like Jeff Lawton once said, you know, modern farming has more akin to mining than it does actual farming.
Right.
I mean,
absolutely.
When you do this right, classic example of is just what we've done this year. We've had, you know, as a byproduct of just good management, we produced in our food forest, let's say 100 gallons of strawberries. Okay, I can only put so many of those back. Pigs and chickens are going to eat some too. And then we're giving them away, that third ethic in permaculture where we give back to earth care and people care, which, you know, obviously means giving some away. We had to literally give away 3 pigs. We had to process and give away 3 pigs because it's been that abundant and unbelievable. I mean, all of the chickens that we processed, all we did was do classes. We did them for free. I don't advise doing that because anything you give away for free, people fundamentally believe is worthless.
People don't value.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So if you can't just give this stuff away for free, and plus you shouldn't, I can make a pretty convincing case as why it probably shouldn't be that way. If you want to put butts in seats, I mean, you give away for free, it's just not going to happen. But anyway, not only am I doing all this, not only am I feeding my family 6 freezers to the brim, I just had to process 2 sheep the other day. I had to call them basically, look, I love you dearly, but if you're not going to make the cut, then in the freezer, you got to go.
That's
so
right.
Point now we have got to, not only is everything you're talking about achievable and really in a pretty small piece of time, and we've done it on degraded land over and over and over again, but things become so abundant with good management that we could sell it easily. We could sell it. But we've given it away, some to a church and some to other people that needed it right here in these mountains. And that's exactly the beauty of the structure you described, folks. Once again, if you're just tuning in now, the Independent Farmstead, you want to go to their website and get it. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's stuff like this that enables you. The name could not be better. The Independent Farmstead, where it's all done right there on the farm. Now, I'm not to that point where we produce everything on the farm. I've talked about other ways in which we go about it, where we mimic basically the family milk cow with, you know, school lunch programs, getting their milk out of this.
That's called a cash cow. No, wait a minute. It is.
Yeah. I mean, there's ways where, but I would highly advise everybody just follow the directions right out of the gate. Don't be like one of those people on Food Network where I pick whatever recipe you want. And somebody will say, well, I didn't have this, so I did this. I didn't have this, so I did this. Well, you didn't actually make the recipes, so you can't really criticize it, but they always do. Right. Folks, They have an instruction book that is available out there, and you need to have it in your library. In fact, to me, it's something of a magnum opus. That combined with all the wonderful things you'll get on their website, you have got to get this. I know a lot of people are listening right now. You're not necessarily watching the YouTube channel. Overwhelmingly, I know you're listening, and we're going to link all their contact information down below. Make absolutely positively sure. I know there's a lot of preparedness books out there. Believe me, they're on my shelf, but there's none, I think, that even comes close, because a lot of those preparedness books are going to be like, okay, get your beans, get your bullets, put all this stuff away. Well, what if you were your own supply? What if you were your own supply? And that's exactly what you're going
to
learn.
That's only going to last for a while. You've got to be able to provide it from your farm. So our website is onecowrevolution.com. We certainly encourage people to come there. But the other thing is, when people struggle, when people have a setback, when people have got a dairy cow and then they're not sure how to do the, how do I raise the calf? How long? Email us. And people say, are you serious? Are you? Yes, we really are. And our email is Sean and Beth. That's all spelled out. SHAWNANDBETH 1960@gmail.com. We really do want to help you. What I tell people is we have a number of people who say, when the things go bad, we're coming to your house. And we don't want them all coming to our house. We want them to go to your house as well. So we want to help you be a good farm too. That's right.
No. Nobody come to the Billy's Jungle Palace of Love. You know, the gates are locked. But I get the point. You definitely. Really, the most preparedness, folks, I've been saying this for how many weeks now? If you go back and listen to the podcast, I'm saying the most consequential book on preparedness. Look, I got all of Joel Scouse and stuff. I got every single preparedness book, one second after, you name it, but not one of them is giving you the how-to the way you're going to find in the independent farmstead. Because it's one thing to have your supply. Yeah, you should have your beans and bullets. I'll be the first. You know, as a U.S. Army sapper, look, I know all about those things. I know exactly how to do these things. But this is the fundamental component that is so missing in the preparedness movement, is your resupply. And nobody ever accounts for that. Or I get these, and look, I'm going to be honest, the people that tell me this 9 times out of 10 have never lived this. They say, well, I'm just going to go hunting. Yeah. Go try that. Tom, Dick, and Harry's going to be out there doing the very same thing. But what if, like one of my buddies who just texted me a little while ago, who's in Colorado going after elk, or at least scouting them. And he's like, I'm not seeing anything. Well, guess what? I got a whole bunch of meat on the hoof out here that I could process just like I did the last two sheep. Going hunting, that's a real good way to supplement it. But there's a reason why it's not called going out killing, because they're not just there waiting on you. Sean and Beth, I mean, it's been such a joy to have you on here. We're going to have you back, because honestly, we didn't even cover.
We just touched the tip of the iceberg.
And I know people are going to be reaching out, folks. All these, every time I do a speaking engagement, you hear me bring their names up, probably more than anybody else. Anytime I'm in a podcast, I bring them up. Why? Because once again, like Richard III said, I think we might be in the winter of our discontent. Yes. And you need to know how to go out there and get this stuff and raise it for yourself. It's more than just beans and bullets. I've raised a son that you can drop him off in the woods right now with wet weather boots and a G-string, and he'll come back the next day with a fire built and a house standing around him. Not everybody's going to be equipped with all that stuff right now. There's a way to overlay all of it. And one of the biggest components out there, look, I don't get anything from promoting their book. I'm saying it because it's been an enormous blessing in my life, and one of the biggest means of how we produce what we do out here. And I'm just so thrilled and overjoyed that I was absolutely able to get them. I think, you know what, here, folks, here's how crazy this is. I've been talking about their book forever and a day, but I've been honestly shy about reaching out to them, because I'm thinking, okay, they got to be so hamstrung and so busy. There's no way they're going to make time, you know, to get on here. I made all these incredible excuses as to why they probably wouldn't come on this show. So I didn't reach out to them, but I had the joy. I mean, I guess you can call it even serendipity, of having run into them at one of the latest festivals, and I had no idea that I was going to hit it off with them so well. And who knew?
Well, is that good? Is that good oaky background?
Well, it's not only that, but whoever knew that Shakespeare would open so many doors?
so many country doors. That's between right. A couple of country boys.
I know. Whoever knew the two guys from Oklahoma would have a bond in Shakespeare? I would have never, ever thought of that, because there's probably not a show that goes on where I'm not using some quote or another. But whoever knew that that would be like, oh, hey, you know this? Yeah, you know that, folks. We've only touched the surface of what you're going to get out there. As we bring it to a close, Sean and Beth, what would you tell folks? I mean, there's a lot of worry going on right now. I read the emails, a lot of people concerned. Before we get into that, first of all, do you have any classes coming up? Do you have anything online? So many people, I'm telling you, yeah, read the book, but if you can get it hands-on or even be in a place where you can do a little Q&A, what availability do you have for people to train with you?
Well, we are happy to go to conferences. Right now, our house burned down in May. We're in the rebuild cycle of that. So having a great time, because there's an architect, there's a drywaller, there's a plumber, there's a timber framer, we've got them all. So they're going to rebuild for us. So that's a lot of fun. But we're putting some of our workshops on hold, our on-farm workshops on hold till that gets rebuilt and we get out of our Airbnb and move back into our house. But we're going to lots of conferences. We're going to Indiana this coming weekend. We're Beth doing some women's retreats. We've got a lot of conferences that we're lining up for next year. So if anybody wants us for a conference, get to us soon so that we can have a date for you. But we do farm consults. We can go to your farm. But what I always write when people ask us to sign our names is, farm with reckless abandon. Just jump in. Don't hesitate. Don't try and make it perfect. Work with what you have, and you will be blessed tremendously if you start following that pattern that God has, which is a pattern of not greed, but a pattern of care and taking care of the soil and the animals that you can find.
And then we usually tack on the end, believe that this works.
Right.
Our trust that nature is not a trick that God's played on us to trip us up, but is really our beautiful home, is the best antidote we know of to discouragement. Stuff's gonna die. You're going to get some years where the squash bugs and the potato bugs wipe out part of your crop or all of your crop. And you need to go in believing nature works. And I'm here as a legitimate part of it to bless it with my management. It's going to be okay.
Folks, couldn't have said it better. We're going to definitely have to have them back on. Sean and Beth, thank you. Oh, my goodness. I know people are going to be blowing up right now, especially in these times. Folks, you cannot get a more consequential book. Okay, does it sound like I'm pimping this thing out? Absolutely. Absolutely, because everybody's asking me, what on earth do we possibly do in these times? Well, like we always say on this show, stay alert, stay alive. Yeah, I'm talking saucy. All they wanna build is a prison world full of pet Tamagotchis. Like a kamikaze, got me out of body like I'm Goku SS3. They wanna push me to the center like a cell. They wanna split up, but the center of the next is me. They want me to battle, but I'm a